Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The latest example of the Lavender Boone's control of culture comes to us from Vermont. Randolph High School in Vermont. Here we go again. I mean, we've been at this from the outset when we were having the locker room fight in District 211 up here in the Northwest Burbs. So in Randolph High School, there's an investigation underway because the purpose is whether or not a man, a boy who identifies as a girl, was harassed or somehow treated improperly during his changing to play volleyball with the girls' team in the girls' locker room.
So he made the girls' team. And the people on the team, there's some ladies, excuse me, and their parents who are not too happy that he's on the team.
Yeah, that's secondary.
That's a separate issue.
Yeah, the issue here is the locker room and his access to the locker room. So right now, just so you understand, let's set the table. The girls' locker room at Randolph High School in Vermont does not allow the girls to change in there, but girls who are not girls can. So the boy can change in the girls' locker room, but the girls can't. Are you following me?
Yeah, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Here's the story.
Vermont education policy says that students can play sports and use whatever locker room corresponds with their gender. But some members of the Randolph girls volleyball team say that they object to having one of their transgender teammates be in the room while they change. I spoke to one of the girls.
It's a huge thing. Everyone's asking, like, so why aren't you allowed in the locker room? Like,
high school student Blake Ellen and her teammates are currently barred from using the locker room after some of the girls on the team objected to allowing a transgender player in the girls' locker room.
My mom wants me to do this interview to try to make a change.
Ellen says the dispute started when the trans student made an inappropriate comment while members of the volleyball team were getting changed. She says her issue is not with having the trans student on the team or at school, but specifically in the locker room.
Biological boys that go in the girls' bathroom, but never a locker room situation.
She says that fellow team members and parents have also raised similar concerns and have approached the school with them. They were told that under state law, the transgender student could use whatever locker room they identified with. In an email to families, school officials said that the school has plenty of space where students who feel uncomfortable with the laws may change in privacy.
They want all the girls who feel uncomfortable, so pretty much 10 girls, to get changed in a single stall bathroom, which would take over 30 minutes, when if one person got changed separately, it would take a minute, like no extra time.
In the email to parents, school officials say they are conducting an investigation into allegations the girls harassed the transgender student.
Right, so it started,
the switch.
Started allegedly with a trans student, the boy, saying something inappropriate and...
while the girls were changing.
And now it's become, oh, the boy was harassed by girls who didn't feel comfortable having him change in their locker room and didn't think it right that everybody should change the way they do things to accommodate him. And so now we have this imbroglio in Randolph High School where the girls cannot use the girls' locker room, but the boy can.
And they have to change in a single stall, which you better get to your away game real early, or you better get ready for your home game real early, because you need to allow 30 minutes plus for each person to go in that stall and change.
The pragmatic part of it is the least important part.
I'm just saying that they're adjusting everything that they do for one person.
That's right.
And that's wrong. But he made a comment, according to what I read, he made a comment about their anatomy, about their bodies.
The point is, why is a boy in the girls' locker room?
He made the team.
Can we just get back to first principles here?
Yeah.
He made the team is not an answer, by the way. Why is a boy on, that prompts the other question. Why is a boy on the girls' volleyball team?
He doesn't think he's a boy. He's transitioning.
Thank you. I think I can follow the position. That's not the point either. The point is, first principles, boys playing girls' sports, and we're not talking about at the collegiate level where scholarships are at stake. We're just talking about girls getting to be girls growing up and play girls' sports with other girls. Is that so horrific? When did that become a hate crime? Can somebody pinpoint that moment for me? And then everybody has to play along, has to pantomime along with this absurdity. Oh, I don't want to say anything. I just, you know, I don't want to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Schools, because schools are on the side of your girls, right? Yeah. That's what Abby Martinez thought. Oh, you haven't heard the story of Abby Martinez?
I have not.
Because, you know, these stories get a lot more dark and a lot more tragic than a fight over locker room stall space. Abby Martinez tried to fight back when an L.A. school, county social workers, and an LGBT group sought to transition her confused 15-year-old daughter, Yaeli. Wait for it. But once Yaeli was moved into foster care and later injected with testosterone, the heartbroken mother could only watch helplessly as the girl spiraled into depression that ended when she stepped in front of an oncoming train. They killed my daughter, Abby Martinez told the Washington Examiner. They had to pick pieces of her off the track. You still comfortable with your virtue signaling or silence in the face of this barbarism? The gentleman from the funeral home told me there's nothing really that you can see or recognize. She went by the name Andrew when she died at the age of 19. Oh. It's a familiar tale for parents across the nation who've lost rights to their children for pushing back against gender transitioning procedures in many states. And so now you've got groups like Moms for Liberty, which was founded by two Florida school board members when they saw critical race theory and the sexualization of children being promoted in their schools that are pushing back. But here's the thing. So you think going along is the path of least resistance, right? Because I don't want to make waves. I don't want my kid to be negatively affected, right? And then they intercede to groom your kid. I mean, I don't know how else you describe this. I know grooming is sets people off. Oh, well, how do you describe this? How do you describe people... intercede, people who are not blood relatives, people who are not mom or dad, and that's a whole separate topic, interceding on behalf of a teenager and able to get custody of that teenager removed from her mom so they can facilitate her transit, her quote-unquote transition, which is just... basically inflame her mental challenges. Doctors never warned me of the side effects with hormone therapy and breast implants, detransitioner says. Abel Garcia began transitioning from male to female at age 19 while living in Southern California. After attempting to live as a young woman for a few years, though, he decided to detransition to a man again, but not without resistance from those who had readily signed off on his hormone treatment and breast implant surgery in the first place. This is one of the many stories of detransitioners who are being shared online and in recent documentaries. Abel Garcia told the Daily Signal he didn't feel masculine enough growing up. He didn't have a strong male role model because his father often was out of the home working. He believed that if I'm, quote, if I'm not good enough to be a man, I must be a woman. He recalls coming across a YouTube video about transgenderism in his early teens. They planted a seed in my mind, but I didn't act on it until after I had left high school. We never got into any actual reason. Then he went to see a therapist. Never got into actual reason for why I thought I was trans, he recalls. And the therapist said that she did not want to gatekeep me. Oh, no, of course. And so it spiraled from there with all of the people in his life either marginalized if they weren't enthusiastic about this transition or facilitating it because, well, that's what you're supposed to do. That's being a right and proper leftist these days. So, yeah, what happens in the locker room doesn't stay in the locker room. You know what I mean? Clay and Wheeling, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. God bless that young girl's soul that stepped in that train. And, the only thing I can hope for is that God rightly justifies these people who do these to these poor souls of these poor kids who have world. What a tragedy on these kids. But anyway, my main point, I'm going to take a step further back from you, Dan. Why kids to go into different gender bathrooms? Why are we allowing kids to transition at all? Gender dysphoria is classified in the DSM as a mental disorder. We don't treat anorexic kids by giving them liposuction. We don't treat schizophrenics by putting tinfoil hats on them and pulling all their teeth out because they say their satellites that the CIA is listening to them by. This is ridiculous. We live in a clown world. Why are we allowing these kids, or anybody in general, to pump themselves full of hormones when they clearly have a classified mental disorder? That's what it is. It's not transgenderism. It's not I'm confused. It's a mental disorder. They are mentally not sound. That's what we have to keep talking about. This mental disorder. It's not transgenderism. Thanks. Mental disorder.
Thanks, Clay. Well, divided opinion on that this week. Last week, I should say. Newsom. Gruesome Newsom in California.
What do you do now?
Signed legislation to designate the state of California as a sanctuary for children and teens seeking medicalized gender transitions. So now your kid can run away to California and get gender transition surgery without mom or dad's notification. Gee, I wonder if that has some connection to the abortion on demand culture as so practiced in California and Illinois. What do you think about that? Kid running away. I mean, I guess, you know, it's okay if your kid doesn't notify you, your daughter doesn't notify you if she's going to have an abortion, your minor daughter, the invasive surgery. No parental rights issue there. So why would there be a parental rights issue if your kid wants to run away to California and mutilate himself or herself, right? Why is it happening? The American Medical Association is asking big tech companies and DOJ to censor, deplatform, investigate, and prosecute journalists who question the orthodoxy of gender surgeries for minors, arguing that public criticism is disinformation. This happened and why? As a result of Matt Walsh's expose on Vanderbilt University, what's going on at Vandy? And we also talked about information circulating about what's going on at UW-Madison. So now the professional association is stepping in a la Marxist school board members to enlist federal law enforcement. And, of course, their companions, big tech, to silence and prosecute those who don't conform. So that's how it happens. If you think you can just, I mean, like everything else, do you understand that retreat does not mean they will not follow you? They get to make a decision, too. So if you think you can just keep your head down, don't say anything, and you'll skate, and that's you're doing your best for your child, and then they'll skate, and there'll never be a problem. Boy, aren't you naive. aren't you naive? And it may turn out, I hope not for you, as it has for some of these other parents, it may turn out that you're tragically naive.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
See Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, Alex Berenson, and many more at Freedom Summit Chicago. Tickets available at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Dan and Amy, and here's how the Chicago Press Corps and the D.C. Press Corps become the Chicago Press Corps and D.C. Press Corps. You want to understand the pipeline?
How does it work?
Well, let's start at Northwestern University, my alma mater.
Mm-hmm.
Every time it's mentioned, the value of my degree declines.
Thank you.
Will again, highly recommend against sending your kids to Northwestern, unless they're really prepared to do intellectual battle. Really prepared to be disliked. The Daily Northwestern reporting on the Safety Act, the Pritzker Purge Law. Medill, you know, it's all the Medill students that run the Daily Northwestern, and I was part of starting a paper. I assume they would probably say fake newspaper, but it was a campus newspaper called the Northwestern Chronicle that we started when I was there with some of my friends at the time.
Is it still operating?
I believe so.
I'll look it up.
Content warning, Daily Northwestern. They're about to talk about the purge law. Content warning for those delicate souls in Evanston. This article has mentions of gun violence and assault.
Are you kidding me?
It says,
what is wrong with people?
Content warning. These are your future leaders in the field of journalism coming out of Medill, which is a hole, but what J school isn't. This article has mentions of gun violence and assault. So, I mean, as an 18 to 22-year-old, if you can handle a mention of gun violence or assault, please don't read any further. For God's sake, stop reading.
You might need counseling.
The
Northwestern Chronicle is still operating.
The act is a huge step forward in reducing incarceration that specifically targets people of color and poor people. Says Kareem Butler, pretrial justice fellow of the Chicago Appleseed Center for Fair Courts. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the act is a huge step forward in reducing incarceration that specifically targets people of color. Now, actually, it specifically targets people who commit violent crimes. Criminals, victims. That's what this is about. Right. Okay. Then they refer to a report published by the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Said that consistently shows black and Latine defendants.
What the heck is Latine?
Latine.
I thought it was Latinx.
That's a new one for me.
It's a new one for all of us.
Latine. Latine.
Latine.
Interesting. The research is irrelevant. I just the Latin A piece. Stephanie Coleman is the policy director for the Children Family Justice Center at Northwestern's Pritzker School of Law.
Okay.
I wonder where she comes down.
I don't know, man.
Yeah.
Tell me more, please. I want to know.
Here's what's going on with the Pritzker Purge Law and all the controversy. Stephanie Coleman from the Pritzker School of Law has the drop on it. There's a lot of political fear-mongering that's happening. Threatening women about safety and saying their safety is in jeopardy has sort of spillover effects, especially with men and their families who are also voters who want to see themselves as protectors. You know, it's just the patriarchy. Men want to position themselves as the protector of the family, and so they're fear-mongering about women's safety. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you from the Pritzker School of Law. So when these dum-dums grow up, I mean, largely through no fault of their own, most of them have probably been sheltered all their life, and they've just gone from one high-status indoctrination camp to another. You go from, you know, like a Nutrier to a Northwestern.
Northwestern, right.
Sort of that sort of example. I mean, obviously, kids come from all over the country, but it's the same sort of most, not all, but most, that's sort of what you're getting. And so they're a fish in water. They don't know they're in water. So then when they grow up, they become Don Craven, the president and CEO of the Illinois Press Association. Positively Dickensian name, Don Craven. Don't tell me God doesn't have a sense of humor. President and CEO of the Illinois Press Association. Talking about the papers to which I'm affiliated because they're obsessed. The entire Illinois Press Association membership, all the media, all the cultural institutions, I said this before, they're all on one side. All the civic institutions, all the educational, they're all on one side. They're all on the opposite side. They're all on the side of Medill, the Illinois Press Association, and the power structure, political power structure in the state. They're all on that side. But you put out some newspapers that challenge the orthodoxy of opinion on public policy issues like the Purge Law, and they lose their minds. Well, to the extent they had discernible gray matter in the first place. The Illinois Press Association has opined on the papers. Don Craven said, these are not newspapers as defined by Illinois law. Membership in the Illinois Press Association requires a member must be a newspaper as defined by the Illinois statute, chapter 715, ILCS, section 5, section 5.5.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I heard you weren't
not a real newspaper.
I heard you weren't a newspaper because I got this in the mail.
Yeah.
Because Channel 5 made this declarative statement that conservative-funded mailers styled as newspapers sent to Illinois voters, not newspapers.
Well, right, because we're not a member of the Illinois Press Association as established by law. We see
established by law.
This is exactly, I mean, this goes back to the founding of our country when Thomas Paine petitioned King George for recognition of Common Sense as a legitimate periodical. No, that didn't happen. No, that doesn't happen. State sanction, state recognition before you're considered a legitimate outlet. That's what the press. Of course, it's defined by law. A newspaper is defined by law. That's the setup to have the state fund the newspapers. Isn't that what you guys want? That's what they want. That's what Pritzker wants. There's been legislation to that end. It's not just for PPP money anymore. Literally, I mean, it's not just for NPR anymore. Literally, the whole play is to use taxpayer funds for local news coverage. Oh, what's happened to the local papers? Because the product was so bad. The news reporting so irrelevant to people's lives, much like the network affiliate newscast, lacking context or consequence to their potential readership. They don't have a readership. They just have a potential readership. And since the economic model, the business model doesn't work anymore, in comes Pritzker. A la Pritzker's School of Law at Northwestern. Be Pritzker's newspaper this and Pritzker's newspaper that. AFL-CIO buying the Sun-Times. I mean, it's just something to see. But this is the anatomy of how you get what you get, where 90% of the press corps, whether it's Chicago or D.C., has one perspective, one, and is increasingly intolerant of dissent. and invokes the state. How is the fourth estate a check on the state when it's citing the state for their recognition, sanction, and potentially someday in the not too distant future funding? How does that work? Is that any inherent conflict anybody can pick up there? I just raise this to ask again the thought exercise I've offered many times. 90% have one perspective. 90% of Medill, not 99% of Medill. 90% though, generally. This is by voting records. Easy enough to go through. You want me to, we could post them again. We've done stories like that before. Oh, that doesn't inform, you know, how I do my job. Sure it doesn't. So let me just ask you the question. If 90% of the Chicago Press Corps or the D.C. Press Corps were conservatives, do you think the coverage on the network affiliate newscasts at the Tribune or Sun-Times, do you think it would be different at all? And if you think it would be different, then why isn't it different when it's 90% leftists? Because they're superhumans? Because they have no perspective? Because they slap the label nonpartisan on their business card?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Can you, I mean, I'm trying to imagine a world like that, and I can't. Because I was in it for 21 years. And I saw, I mean, you'd have to fight to get the other side when it comes to political pieces. And then the political reporters that they all had an agenda. Well, back then they did.
But back then, improved? It's deteriorated as their relevance has lessened. The more their relevance has been diminished, the more radical left they've gone. They've got to serve, you know, the chorus.
Well, they treat the politicians well, so they can have access to them. And if the competition gets access and they don't, then, oh, everybody's panties are in a bunch. Why didn't you get that interview?
Excuse me. They treat the politicians well so they can one day work for them. Which is exactly what happens. Watch when people leave the news profession in D.C. or Chicago and where they end up.
Jordan Abadayu, she worked at Springfield.
They end up
as a reporter and did a hit job on Rauner before she left.
They end up on some Dem politician staff as some Dem party apparatchik consultant, functionary in a corporate setting that's also political in nature, aligned with the established power structure. Just watch them move. Watch where they end up. We could go chapter and verse over the last 20 years. I could give you name after name after name.
Unless you're Carrie Lake.
Well, the Chicago Tribune, speaking of the leftist legacy media, leftist legacy media, that is. They published an op-ed I wrote on the Safety Act yesterday.
Really?
So they can pretend to be a real newspaper. And, I was happy to do it because it's just an opportunity to twist all those leftists who propagandist, right-wing extremist. His commentary can't be allowed in our hallowed journals.
Uh-huh. All right.
And, I'm not going to read my own work here. I tweet it out. You can get it at the Tribune. I don't think it's behind a paywall. I don't know if it'll be in print today for those five people who still get the print version or not. But we're going to have the Kendall County State's Attorney Eric Weiss in studio at the top of the 8 o'clock hour to talk about this. It's an actual practitioner. But, you know, in here, I'm just reiterating, because I think it's a good resource for people. I quote exclusively Democrat state's attorneys, Democrat county state's attorneys, their views on Pritzker's purge law. Like, for example, this bill is an absolute disgrace. It threatens the very existence of the criminal justice system and endangers our communities. Please make your voice heard and contact the governor's office. That's what Democrat Alexander County State's Attorney Zachary Gowen wrote on his Facebook page on the day the bill passed in January of last year. How about up here in the burbs. Kane County State Attorney Jamie Mosser. Criminal justice reform should not come at the expense of the safety of our community. It's my opinion that forcing this reform through with the altruistic purpose of getting the reform we need will set our movement back. I urge you to make changes and take the time to meet with those who share your goal. And the Democrats, Welch, Harmon, Pritzker, said, no thanks. So as I ask here, as I've asked before, simple point, and this is what I think you should push to those who are ill-informed or skeptical or buffaloed by Jelly Belly's rap. As you try to dissect the misinformation being thrown around by supporters of the Purge Law, focus on one point, simple point. If the act's opponents are fearmongers, as the governor has claimed, how does it explain the many state's attorneys of all political persuasions across the state who collectively say the law is fundamentally dangerous? If the law is so solid, why are the experts on the ground so worried, like 100 of the 102 state's attorneys in Illinois? That does not give you pause. They don't know perhaps something that you don't know, is what I would challenge people to consider, people who are skeptics or ill-informed. They don't know something you don't know. They don't know how this will impact what they do on a daily basis. County sheriffs don't know what it'll mean for those currently in their custody. It's just, semantic cleanup that's needed on the legislation, which is what the governor said the other day. There's some clarity of language that could be obtained so that people are not confused about what the law does. Really, all these state's attorneys, all these sheriffs, all these police chiefs, they're confused. They're confused. Not law enforcement expert J.B. Pritzker. He's not the one that's confused or lying. Everybody else is confused or fear-mongering. You believe that? Does anybody believe that, really? And what's happening under a de facto purge law, as we have in Cook County? Kerry Mamala, not that I should say his name, but arrested by Chicago police for the 14th time this year after going on a mini crime spree in Lakeview. Yeah, that was last week. He pled guilty to the Lakeview charge. He got out of jail. Then he got arrested by Chicago police at the Merchandise Mart for a 15th time this year.
15th?
Everybody deserves a 16th chance, don't they? Mini crime spree, they call what he did at Lakeview last week.
What makes it a mini crime spree?
Because
he probably traumatized somebody.
An assault at Jewel Osco.
That's not a mini.
Yeah.
That's assault. That's a felony.
Threatened to punch a female manager who confronted him for shoplifting at Walgreens as well.
That monster should be behind bars.
Yeah, and stole $135 worth of clothing.
Well, that's not going to get you in jail.
Mm-hmm. He was on conditional discharge for trespassing at the time of those incidents. He pled guilty to the retail theft at Walgreens and also Gap, and got sentenced to another conditional discharge. And then he was arrested at the Merchandise Mart. Representatives there say they had told him on multiple occasions he was not allowed on their property. Gee, I wonder why.
But that'll change January 1st.
He's charged with criminal damage to property and criminal trespassing. Wouldn't even be arrested. He'd be ticketed.
Right.
15 times this year.
That's too many chances.
You think?
I mean, I don't care what his sad story is, but enough's enough.
Chuck, Delavan, Wisconsin.
Chuck.
I got two police officers from Rockford. They deer hunt my property and stuff. And they've been over there and telling me, and they said that they're very, very concerned because they're going to turn 400 criminals loose out of that Winnebago County jail. And they said they don't have like a place to go or whatever. and they said they're going to end up eventually going to have to go out and re-catch all those people when they go to commit their next crime. And they're, you know, getting ready for that, but they're very, very concerned. So
yeah, thanks for the call. We had the Winnebago County Sheriff on last week saying just that. I guess he's just another fearmonger, according to J.B. Pritzker.
Okay. Coming up on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Will Latino voters drive the GOP's takeover of the House and Senate on November 8th? We'll discuss the midterm, 6:06.
But now straight into the newsroom. Here is Mike Scott.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Midterms, 5 weeks away.
Goodness.
And out comes this survey done by NBC Telemundo showing support among Latinos for the Democrat Socialist has dropped considerably over the last decade. Now, again, the majority still support Democrats, but a decade ago was a 42-point spread. Today, according to this survey, 21-point spread, cut in half. And the trend lines are continuing to improve for Republicans. I mean, you see that evidence of that is, for example, Myra Flores's surprise win in El Paso. So, you know, still a lot of work to do. It should be the other way, if not a wider margin in favor of Republicans. But it is interesting that you have so many Latinos that are moving politically because, well, because they're practical people, like most people are practical, and they're looking around and saying, wait a second, am I interest being served by these people?
I got to tell you, and it's so bad, and they're so concerned that NBC News sent Jose Diaz to places like Arizona and El Paso to talk to people. And here's Maria, and he's like shocked looking at her like, what, you were a Democrat, why are you a Republican?
Maria, you were a Democrat, and you are now a Republican?
What?
Why?
Because the fact that the Democratic Party has changed a lot and identify more with the Republican Party.
What things?
Well, we're for God, country, family, and hard work.
Yeah.
And the look on his face like, oh, my God.
It's a mix. You know, they got people that are open borders people to the AOC acolytes that he interviewed. But, yeah, Maria Batres and her husband, Jose Arreola, who we interviewed, this couple from El Paso, they were very good. I mean, this is what I'm talking about. These are older people who've seen a thing or two, who were Democrats. They sort of bought the initial pitch. And now they're looking around and saying, and they live in El Paso, they're looking around saying, no, I don't think so. Border security is an issue for us because we live in El Paso. And what she just said, you know, our values of God, country, work don't seem to be trumpeted by Democrats. And not to mention, you know, the price of groceries, which we'll get to as well, not limited to Latinos.
We're not just going to blindly vote in one particular direction. We're going to vote in the direction of folks who are going to be paying attention to the issues that are important to us.
That's Carolina Rodriguez from Mi Familia, Arizona. And she, you know, and one woman just said, you looked at me, you took me for granted because I was Hispanic, that I would naturally vote Democratic.
How is it that you feel as a voter here?
Taken advantage of. I feel like the Democratic National Party looks at my demographics and assumes that I'm going to vote for them. I'm a Latina woman that historically has been the party's bread and butter.
And she's not anymore because she's worried about, yes, what you just mentioned, border security, inflation, the housing market. She's shopping for a house, and the mortgage rates are so high that it's not even obtainable right now. Well, 7% on a 30-year fixed.
Yeah, you have.
You buy a $400 house, you're talking looking at $883,000 down the line.
You have $300,000 now plus, $300,000 plus less purchasing power than you did when Trump left office.
I mean, think about that.
It's a big number.
Yeah. You want to live like this? Because I don't.
This is having an impact, not just at the border. It's having an impact in Nevada, where both the Republican candidates for governor and Senate currently lead those races. That both would be pickups. The MSN reporting here. Latinos are threatening to stay home. That's despite the presence of the first ever Latina elected to the United States, to the U.S. Senate, Catherine Cortez Mastro, at the top of the ballot. Mm-hmm. Organizers in both parties say they see the same phenomenon developing, as do major Latino groups and the powerful Culinary Workers Union. Disgruntled over the economy and unhappy with their post-pandemic job quality, these voters, many of whom are Democrat groups, identify as many of whom Democrat groups identify as once lifelong supporters, could sit this one out. That's on top of the usual challenges of turning out voters for midterm elections. And so, it's a real thing. It's a real dynamic that's happening, both the disaffection, you know, it sort of starts with disaffection and then you kick the tires and maybe you move over to a full on party change. It's a process. And by the way, as I mentioned, They're not the only ones. A new survey out by the Trafalgar Group. 70% of likely 2022 voters indicate the price of groceries is impacting their motivation to vote. 70%. And half saying that motivation has increased very much.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not getting any better at the grocery stores.
Yeah,
it's getting worse every time you go.
They're not happy and they're motivated to express their unhappiness, and that usually does not benefit the party in power. That's what we're seeing across the board, and of course that would include Latino voters. This is the point, because you understand, you see what the Democrats are doing, not able to talk about substantive accomplishments, not able to talk about a booming economy, clearly. So what do they talk about? They talk about this being a fight to save our democracy from insurrectionists who threaten our democracy and would put women back in chains because of the Dobbs decision. That's essentially what they're left with. But as Joel Kotkin writes in a very good piece at Unheard, Joel Kotkin from Chapman University, Coming of Neo-Feudalism. If you haven't read that book, read it. Coming of Neo-Feudalism, Joel Kotkin. It's very good on the dynamic at play in this country right now and has been for years. To avoid talking about the lousy economy, Democrats have sought to make the election about abortion and the threat to democracy posed by extremist Republicans. Right-wing extremists like me!
Yes.
Right?
I don't know if you read the latest tweet from Mr. Speaker of the House. Dan, he's got a tweet. This is from, Manuel Chris Welsh.
Uh-huh.
If you see a newspaper under such titles as DuPage Policy Journal, Will County Gazette, Chicago City Wire. These are lies, all capital letters, being sold by right-wing extremists, the same people who supported the January 6th insurrection and want to see the Trump agenda brought to Illinois.
That's a good example of exactly what Joel Kotkin's writing about. First, I tried to overthrow the government. Now I'm trying to overthrow the Pritzker. I know. It's terrible. Reading the mainstream media, writes Kotkin, one would be forgiven for believing the upcoming midterms are part of a Manichaean struggle for the soul of democracy, pitting righteous progressives against the authoritarian ultra-MAGA hordes. The truth is nothing of the sort. Even today, the vast majority of Americans are moderate and pragmatic. The apocalyptic ideological struggle envisioned by the country's elites has little to do with how most Americans actually live and think. For most people, it's not ideology, but the powerful forces of class, race, and geography that determine their political allegiances and how they will vote come November. And that's right, and this is why it's such a struggle, even no matter how much evidence you present, to get people to move off those affiliations which drive their vote. I mean, the struggle to get Latinos to consider Republican and conservative candidates who more closely align with their values. The same goes for black families, the struggle to get black families to consider people who actually align more with their values because of the pull of race and class. So it's a process, but it's happening because of the ties that bind and because of the performance of those who have the reins of power. And because 57% of Latinos, going back to just that demographic, 57% of Latinos think the country's on the wrong track. If you think the country's on the wrong track, if you think grocery prices are too high and you're worried about the ability to pay for them on a monthly basis, and that's motivating you to vote, that, as I said, that's not good news for incumbents, particularly at the top. Tom, Blue Island, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Again, and Amy, when you hear that reporter's voice, you can sense that smarminess directly out of the Joe Biden comment, if you don't vote for me, you ain't black. There's an attitude with the leftists that if you don't just go along with their predictions, what they foresee for you and your race, that somehow you're an outlier and you're to be shamed.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right. Thanks. Shame on you. That's right. And, you know, here's the thing, though. What does the Democrat Socialists really have to offer? It's a tough sell they have, really, once you get past the race hustle, which is why they never get past it.
Right, because they have nothing. There's no accomplishments.
No, but instead of accomplishments, what's their real pitch? What are they selling? They're selling dependency, right? They're selling, come with us, and you can live in the warm embrace of the state. The rectum.
The rectum, the warm embrace of the
America's
butt
rectum.
Baby. The butt babies.
Yeah, the
everybody
warm embrace.
Can be a butt baby.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're all butt babies now. Living in the warm embrace of the rectum, which is the federal government. But that's essentially what they're offering. And it runs afoul of something that is universal. Right? The things that are universal, we don't talk enough about, which is that people want to live freely. People want to be in charge of their own destiny. They do not want to be dependent on the state. They do not want to be told what to do, much less shamed about what they're doing or not doing. But life is tough. Life is difficult. And so sometimes you say, well, it'd just be easier if I ceded some of my sovereignty to the state. And they promise they'll let me more or less live freely. So they just chip away at over time by saying, no, of course you can live freely. Of course you can call your own shots. But, you know, you got to fall in line when we tell you to fall in line. Just remember. And people don't like it. They bristle at that. They should. That's the great thing about human beings. As I said, the yearning to be free, it's innate, which is why we call it a human right. So you have to avoid the siren song of the left when it comes to dependency, and don't allow them to rationalize their dilution of your individual sovereignty. Well, you can't go with them. They're a bunch of racists. You can't go with them. They're homophobes and transphobes and misogynists and non-allies and so on and so forth. That's essentially their pitch. Their pitch is always, chains, really, to borrow a phrase from Mr. 10%, the big guy, President Biden. He was projecting again when he put it on Mitt Romney, although Mitt Romney is no hero in this story, of course. But the point is about what the left's pitch is. It is actually a pretty tough pitch to sell if you step back and take a close look at it. And when people are hurting, they will take a step back and look at it. When things are you know, going along okay and everything seems to be relatively hunky-dory, you know, you let people get away with stuff you wouldn't let them get away with in more dire times. Well, we're in more dire times. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. You know, I think it was an American Thinker the other day. There was an article by a guy who talked about the need to move our capital city and almost have our suggestion was to have our Congress meet electronically by Zoom because, I mean, the capital city has become, it's become Babylon. It's become Rome. And the different politicians who are there, Republican or Democrat, just get into that culture and they make friends there and they're on both sides of the aisle and then nothing ever really gets done for the people back in the provinces.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, you know, we can talk about the Democrats being as horrifying as they are, but the Republicans are just, you know, a diet version of them in some respects, partially because of the centralization of everything in D.C. I mean, we should be having we should be talking about an 1894 style 100 seat blowout. That's what we should be talking about. But instead, if we win the House, I'm sure we probably will, but it'll be, you know, it could very well be an unimpressive gain of 20 to 30 seats. And, you know, we'll have a majority, but is Kevin McCarthy really going to be a leader who can change the direction of this country, end this age of progressivism? I mean, I don't think so. I don't see that out of him. If we win the Senate, we'll be able to have some investigative powers and we'll make some of them look bad, but is anybody really going to go to jail for all these crimes against the American people all these years? I doubt it. I mean, there needs to be fundamental, substantive change, perhaps in the way that we're governed. And although, you know, moving the Capitol may be a radical move, something like that. We need to, Donald Trump was talking about moving some of the agencies out to the states and not having them all centralized in D.C. We need real reform. Otherwise, this country's going to fall apart at some point in the next 50 years or whenever it is. This country's not going to last. It really isn't, because you don't have a government that has the mandate of heaven anymore. You don't. They don't look out for the interests of the people. They look out for the interests of the rich and the upper classes and their friends, some of whom are overseas. It's really disgusting.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Good comments, as always. David in Winnetka.
Yeah, hey, guys. Good morning. Dan, Amy, first I just want to acknowledge you for your humor. Everybody deserves a 16th chance. If, with your permission, I'm going to market that. Put on
yeah,
a poster.
Yeah, right.
Get a T-shirt.
I'm not without mercy, David. You know,
everyone deserves a 16th chance.
Speaking on the Hispanic population, when I was a little boy, my mother remarried a Chinese man that had a restaurant in Lake Forest, and we moved out there. He housed and gave room and board to three Hispanic gentlemen that worked in the kitchen probably, I don't know, 14, 16 hours a day. We all lived in the basement together, and I would watch them save up big piles of money and send them, you know, for their families. Yep. And, you know, truly coming to the red just simplifies basics. They want to join the side that is not only works, but wants to work and is willing to work. And America owes so much of its backbone to everything they do. And last, I just want to throw in that there was a comedian one time that that sits the American guy, like, you know, in complaining, like, they come over and they take our jobs, they want our jobs, and blah blah. And he goes, so this guy shows up wearing ripped up jeans, no shirt, doesn't speak English, and that guy takes your job? That guy? Well, you must suck. All right.
Yeah, thanks for the call, David. Well, you heard from the woman who lives in El Paso. God,
Maria.
Country, work. Ralph Rantoul.
Hey, good morning, Dan. I got a slightly different take on this. I think it is all about freedom, but it's about people making a choice between actual freedom, which they oftentimes don't really appreciate, and free stuff. And they want free stuff, and it's only when their reception of free stuff, the cost starts getting so high, like transaction cost. So when free stuff gets too expensive and they start feeling the effects on their freedom, then they're kind of wakened out of their, you know, administrative state stupor, and they start thinking about stuff. I don't know. You seem to have more faith in people than I do. I'm thinking about marketing a bumper sticker that says, you know, those of you that still have a lot of faith in humanity haven't spent a lot of time around people. And I just don't have the same high regard for the general public's appreciation for our Constitution, for our freedoms. And, you know, it's only when they start thinking, well, wait a minute, wait, they want to affect what part of me for that? Oh, yeah, you know, all that free crap that you insist upon that you suck off of the government. Yeah, that's got a cost to it, and it's called your dependency, and your freedoms are being stolen. Wake up, people. I just don't think it's there, Dan and Amy. They don't get it, unfortunately, until it's almost too late.
Thanks for the call, Ralph.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Don't miss Freedom Summit Chicago on November 5th. Get your tickets today before they sell out. Go to freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Interesting survey research from our friend Professor Eric Hoffman, Birkbeck University of London College. Across the pond there, merry old England. America's elite university students, that's who was surveyed here. Elite university students more demographically diverse than the general population, but more politically divided along the lines of race, gender, sexuality, and religion. Minority and female students are far more liberal on campus than in the general population, whereas straight white Christian men are somewhat more conservative on campus than in the general population. Current trends portend a politics in which elite women, minorities, gays, and the non-religious are more left-leaning, while elite whites, males, and Christians remain relatively conservative. That's sort of unsurprising, but it's good to document. Some of the other numbers, though, when you start to dig in, a quarter of students at America's elite universities are on the LGBT spectrum, they say. 25%. It just shows you the social contagion aspect of it, I would argue.
Do you believe that number?
Well, I believe it when you add the social contagion piece of it, yeah.
Okay.
Ivy League schools average 10 to 15% conservative, 60 to 75% liberal. Across 150 leading schools, there are nearly 2.5 liberals for every conservative. I'm surprised the number's not bigger. Uh-huh. This is interesting. The most conservative campus, most diverse in terms of viewpoint.
What?
University of Arkansas, students are 35% conservative, 37% liberal, 36% Republican, 41% Democrat. So it's basically split, although lean still left. the most conservative campus surveyed leans left. Smith College, by contrast, 81% liberal, 1% conservative, 78 to 2 Democrat to Republican.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And where do all of those leading lights of the humanities and institutions like journalism come from? Not the University of Arkansas. Just very interesting how it informs the distortion we were talking about a little bit in our discussion of the midterms, the distortion of what most people are actually thinking about and how they're thinking about issues as contrasted to the portrayal of what's important by the D.C. press corps and the allied institutions, right? The D.C. press corps, for the D.C. press corps, the midterm elections is a referendum on the salvation of our democracy. Are you interested in saving our democracy from white-wing extremists or not? And then the actual people are like, the price of groceries is what's most important to me. Existential battle. I'm trying to get by. Yeah.
I'm living paycheck to paycheck. You know, climate change. No, people don't care about that right now. They care about feeding their children.
The thickness of the bubble, you know, has not... the thickness of the public has not winnowed at all since 2016, when that was the order of the day post-Trump surprise victory. For more on all this, pleased to be joined by Peter Berkowitz, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, former director of policy planning at the State Department. You can get his writings at peterberkowitz.com. Peter, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
Well, your piece about the left seeing extremism only on the other side is timely because, again, they're they continue to be surprised and saddened and maddened and aghast when elections don't turn out how they expect them to, when people are elevated that they don't understand. And it happened again recently with Giorgia Meloni in Italy.
Yes, that's right. And with, as you know, the Sweden Democrats in Sweden earlier in this month. And it is astonishing to see the repeated surprise and shock on the part of so many intellectuals. After all, we've been watching a wave sweep Western-style liberal democracies, at least since 2016 with Brexit in Britain. And as you said, Trump's surprise victory in 2016. The United States, I'd go back at least as far, one could go back much farther, but at least as far to the Tea Party elections of 2010. And everywhere you see a similar pattern. Ordinary people are growing increasingly upset, even angry with what they regard as distant, detached elites who are ruling in their own interest and neglecting, as you all were saying just a moment, kitchen table, pocketbook issues.
Well, tell us what happened in Sweden exactly.
Well, you have the rise of a party called the Sweden Democrats, which, as the critics say, has disreputable origins. It's true. There are some neo-Nazi forces connected to it originally, decades ago, but they have since explicitly rejected fascism. And by the way, we should put in parentheses, if unlovely origins of parties were disqualifying, we would have to disqualify the Democratic Party for its connection, for its support of the Ku Klux Klan and Jim Crow.
I second your motion. Yes.
But in any case, if we were to do that, in any case, clearly the party now is not driven, I would say, by fascist sentiments, but rather it's driven by the people of Sweden's concern with the massive wave of crime that has swept the country since Sweden admitted more immigrants in the mid-2010s per capita than any other European Union nation. And many of those immigrants came from Middle Eastern, young men from Middle Eastern countries, Muslim-majority countries. And it has proven extremely difficult to assimilate those immigrants. So again, these are voters who are voting not out of an authoritarian ideology, but because they want to make the streets of Sweden safe again.
And in your piece about the progressive left at realclearpolitics.com, and I assume at peterberkowitz.com too, you referenced David Leonhardt from the New York Times.
Yeah.
This is a good example of what I was talking about, at least, but get your take on it. The threat to our democracy is his latest apocalyptic tome, the twin threats to America's democracy. And, of course, one of them, as you write, is a movement inside one of the country's two major parties to refuse to accept defeat in an election. This just in, you might want to draw Mr. Leonhardt's attention to it. Stacey Abrams' challenge to the 2018 election in Georgia is rejected in court. A judge who is an Obama appointee, although Georgia's election system is not perfect, the challenge practices violate neither the Constitution nor the Voting Rights Act, and so on and so forth. So 4 years after the fact, Stacey Abrams has failed to make out her case in court, even though she's a cause celeb in the press corps, and I assume among Mr. Leonhardt as well.
I think you're right, and one could go on in that vein. According to Mr. Leonhardt, somehow the Republicans have invented the idea of challenging elections, but in fact, the most dramatic challenge in this century came from Al Gore in the 2000 presidential election when, as you all recall, he went to the courts and he asked for selective recounts in county Democratic majority counties to attempt to overturn George W. Bush's apparent victory and we can go up to
right. Oh, but that election. But that election was stolen by Antonin Scalia, so that one was stolen, Peter. But these other ones where they win, never stolen.
Well, yes, even back then, what one really needed to say that he who lives by the courts dies by the courts.
Right.
It is true. We should observe that it is odd for the Supreme Court to make a decision that that helps determine election. But the person who legalized the matter and took it to courts was Gore, not George W. Bush. And so what would have been really odd is if a decision by a Florida court had decided that election. In any case, we also have Hillary Clinton throughout Donald Trump's presidency declaring his presidency illegitimate. So one point, and it's a crucial point, especially, and the Stacey Abrams case you mentioned. By the way, there are other instances, 2004, but this is hardly restricted to the right challenging the results of elections. But a second point we have to make clear, it's constantly blurred by the media, is that it's possible to recognize Joe Biden as the lawful president. After all, the states certified their votes on December 14th, 2020, and that decided matters, but still maintain that there were very serious irregularities in election 2020. And moreover, we should have expected serious irregularities because we loosened up voting procedures in order to respond to the problems of COVID-19.
You know what that is? That kind of rhetoric. That's an insurrectionist dog whistle right there.
I understand how it will be so charged. Nevertheless, when you make it significantly easier to vote, it's reasonable to suppose that there will be more abuses of the voting system. One can maintain that and nevertheless maintain that once Joe Biden was certified on December 14th, he's the lawful president. We have to be able to both recognize the law and assert the truth.
That sort of texture thinking has no place in our politics. The second pillar, just to get to the second tower, looming tower, the policymaking disconnected from public opinion. No, not what you're thinking. This is a New York Times columnist. So this is conservative minorities in the Senate stopping good public policy supported, of course, overwhelmingly by the left majority, because in their world, everything that they advance is an 80% plus issue with the public.
Yes. David Leonhardt writes as if the sole aim of the American federal government is to respond to majority will, which could also be majority whim, could be majority passion, when it's really quite clear that the fundamental purpose of American constitutional government is to protect rights. And there are a variety of constraints built into constitutional government to actually contain, control, check majority will in order to protect those rights. So to say that the government at any one point that the government is not reflecting majority will, it does not amount to a serious criticism of the Constitution. Within constitutional limits, the will of the majority should prevail. Leonhardt is especially upset that the Supreme Court does not reflect majority will. But the Supreme Court, above all, has the job of protecting rights and policing the boundaries of the Constitution, not reflecting majority will.
It's remarkable, all this chatter about saving our democracy. I guess they mean eliminate our representative republic so that we can have a plebiscite democracy. Maybe that's what they mean by it, because they don't seem to have much respect for the representative Republican form of government we actually have, as they're running around saying everything should be done 50% plus one.
Well, I think that's right, and you make a crucial point. The Democrats can hardly claim to have a mandate. The presidential election was very close. At the end of the day, Joe Biden defeated Donald Trump with, I think, about a total of 44,000 votes spread across three crucial states. The margins in the House were reduced, and as you just alluded to, there's a 50-50 tie in the Senate. So the Democrats actually can scarcely be said they have a majority in the House, and they won the presidency, tied in the Senate. They hardly have a mandate to enact society and politics transforming laws. So one should say that what's happening over the last 2 years, that is Republicans checking their efforts for dramatic legislation, is not a glitch in the system, but the system, the government system, acting as the founders envisaged.
He is Peter Berkowitz, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, former director of policy planning at the State Department, and you find his writings at peterberkowitz.com. Peter, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks for being with you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So this contretemps over rapper Lizzo being afforded the opportunity to play James Madison's flute, the glass flute from a gift from a French manufacturer on the occasion of his second inauguration. So yeah, more than 200 years ago.
It's a crystal flute. It's beautiful if you've ever seen it. I wouldn't even want to touch it.
Now, first of all, does everybody know who Lizzo is? You know, having to be the Kurt Loder of Salem Broadcasting, I feel it's incumbent upon me to make sure everybody's reading from the same script here.
Everybody knows who Lizzo is.
Oh, really?
Don't you think?
What was her breakout song?
I put the jing-a-ing-a-ing-a-ing in a jingle. What's the name of that song, Justin?
Please. Let's leave it to the professionals. How many times do I have to tell you?
I know I have a cold, so my head voice is gone right now. I can't project.
It's the cold.
Like I normally would.
This is Lizzo.
Thank you.
She has a bit of a head cold, too, I think. Maybe that.
Truth hurts.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm 100% that bitch. Even when I'm crying crazy, I got
heavens.
Boy problems.
My virgin ears.
Bling, bling, then I solve them. That's the goddess in me.
You could have had a bad bitch, not committal. Help you with your career, just a little. You both
kind of like
down,
it, actually.
But you're holding me back, and that's the sound. I mean, not calling you back. Why am I in gray till they gotta be gray? Don't text me and tell it straight to my face.
So here's the thing
that's
about that.
What you and I only know.
It's kind
of the last part of that.
I don't.
We know is bum 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 bum.
No, I've dissected the song. I'm an art critic.
Okay,
this is my own mind. And so the one thing I didn't like, the new man on the Minnesota Vikings. That seems like she came up with Minnesota Vikings just because of the rhyme scheme. Yes, I don't like throwaway phraseology.
So what is
like
she saying there? What is happening?
Here's the other. First of all, I'd like her to try that with a flute.
Okay.
I'd like her to try that, play Truth Hurts with Madison's flute, maybe in a future concert. But she did give us a line that I use all the time.
Which is?
She said, I put the sing in single.
I put the sing in single. Yeah. Ain't worry about a ring.
Yeah.
The sing in single,
sort of,
Dan?
She's sort of my North Star in a way, sort of a mentor to me. All right, so that's who Lizzo is.
Yes.
For those of you not down on the scene like myself. And so she does this tour of, Library of Congress and gets introduced to Madison's flute. That is not a metaphor.
And she seemed very gracious if you watch the video. Very surprised. Like, I could play this?
Well, here's the thing about it, and this has been underreported. There's been a lot of criticism of her performance. We'll get to that. But she played the flute growing up.
Right. That's why they let her play the flute, I thought.
Well, she said in an interview with CBS in 2019, I remember in fifth grade, I just wanted to be really good. I was like, I want to be really good at the flute. Everybody else is so bad. And it was hard to be good at it. It's a very difficult instrument. I became like obsessed with being good. So, I mean, there's a connection. It's not just random, random assignment here. So a lot of conservative commentators have said her performance in part because of her.
Well, she's scantily clad. I mean, she's practically naked. But that's what they do. That's what the kids do now.
It's
a lot of lady there.
Yeah,
but you know what? That's people.
No, I know. Of course. But
freedom
please,
of expression.
Not going to fat shame. No, not me.
No. I'm not either.
Gorgeous. Gorgeous. Gorgeous.
I'm looking at it right now.
Gorgeous.
Well, that's a lot of sequins.
Sequins?
Yeah. That's what I meant. Yeah. Sequins.
But
sorry, I have a cold.
The suggestion was that this was a desecration because she's wearing some, she's scantily clad because she's bouncing around, shaking her moneymaker and all that jazz. Mm-hmm. But I actually agree with Chris Scalia's take on this. He wrote about it in the Wall Street Journal. I'm sure.
Hey, who wants a Lizzo assignment? What?
Chris Scalia.
That's you. You're on it.
Matriculated at William & Mary and got his PhD in English Lit, I think, or some humanities from UW Madison, son of Antonin Scalia. I'm sure someday he thought he would be writing about Lizzo and James Madison's flute, but he did. And he said, two cheers for Lizzo and James Madison's crystal flute.
Can we hear it? We have the...
He writes, true, Lizzo's suggestive dancing detracted from the historical significance of her playing an instrument that once belonged to the father of the Constitution. So did her swearing. She really likes to swear. And her outfit, which looked like something Liberace would have designed for Richard Simmons. That's a great line. See, this is why he's got the PhD. That's a great line.
That is so true.
It's really true. Yet it's unfair to dwell on these details without noting that she told the audience the history of the flute. She also raved, history is cool, you guys. Not exactly Thucydides, but closer to him than anything I've ever heard at a concert. In these ways, she showed real respect for the instrument, which makes it hard to imagine the moment as a deliberate attempt to disparage America's past. Rather, it was more of a clumsy attempt to celebrate it. Yeah, I think that's right.
And now she's, according to TMZ, she's been invited to James Madison's crib to play the flute again for possibly a flute jam session.
Oh, boy.
It didn't just end the other night on stage.
Is Kenny G going to be there? They're going to have a flautist off? It's flutist, actually.
Flutist?
Yeah.
But doesn't he play the clarinet?
We'll get all the woodwinds there.
Be sure to wet your reed.
Uh-huh.
People who play the clarinet know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Is that music jargon?
Well, I played the French horn. My sister played the clarinet. Another one played the flute. Did you play an instrument growing up?
No.
Piano, anything?
It's a real regret. I never learned to play an instrument. I guess I still can. No.
The piano?
No, I just pour white trash from Wheaton. So we didn't have those.
And you're homeless now. And you're an insurrectionist. And
yeah.
How are you doing, though? I brought you food today and fresh vegetables because I have to help out my homeless friends.
I do want to play. Maybe there's still time for me to learn to play an instrument.
You could still play. You can learn to play the piano.
Yeah, like the piano or the guitar, something, relatively accessible.
You get more chicks if you play the guitar.
Is that right?
I would go for the guitar.
Yeah, thanks for the tip.
Or you could do the ukulele.
Sure, like Tiny Tim.
A lot of kids are doing that.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, it's very relaxing. I like it.
Yeah. Okay, I'll be tiptoeing through the tulips. Related story. After musical artist and professional twerker Lizzo made waves by playing James Madison's crystal flute on stage, Beyonce upped the ante by performing in Times Square wearing George Washington's false teeth.
I know. First of all, okay, I saw that. Her real teeth are great. She doesn't need to put on his false teeth.
It's a Babylon Bee story.
Oh!
She didn't actually perform in Madison Square Garden wearing George Washington teeth. Are you out of your mind? You actually bought that? This is the problem. It's just fake news. More fake news. It's also difficult to tell the difference between. It's a Babylon Bee story.
It is a joke. It is a joke.
Oh, boy.
Oh, my God. All right. Can I dismiss myself now?
Yeah. So where do you come down on
I think it's great. It teaches people about history. I bet a lot of people didn't know James Madison before, and now they know who he is, and now they know about the crystal flute, and I think it's great. I'm not offended by it at all. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah.
But that's her thing. That's her shtick. She always wears clothes like that. That's who she is.
Maybe go with something a little less flattering and dial down a little bit more flattering, I should say. Yeah,
okay.
A little bit more flattering.
Yeah.
And, you know, just turn down the twerking 15 degrees, 15, 20 degrees. Is that possible?
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Time now for another reason why Dan Puff is single.
That's right, me and Lizzo. Me and Lizzo. I want to play Madison's flute, too.
I'm sure you do, Dan.
I know. Have you heard about the D-bag tax?
The D-bag?
The D-bag tax that women are charging.
Well, I'll sign me up for that.
Sarah was fed up. This New York City social worker had countless dates cancel on her at the last minute. So when a man she met on an app recently pulled out of their date an hour beforehand, she agreed to reschedule with one caveat. He'd Venmo her a $50 deposit.
Oh, no. Let me guess, her name is Karen.
I'm just done with my time and energy being wasted. In almost every other scenario, when someone books a time of their day dedicated to you, they have a no-show policy or a security deposit. And so $50 down. The man agreed to her terms, sent her money. They met up for a drink. He was fully engaged the entire time. He had properly been properly chastened, paying for their cocktails, offering to buy them food to share. This is apparently something that a lot of women are doing. For me, it's just it's Martha Duke, 38. Hey, you're on the clock, honey. For me, she said, it's a way to just be like, you're a D-bag. Here's the monetary value of my time you wasted. She said she sent around 6 Venmo requests ranging from $1,500 to $3,000, depending on the financial situation of the D-bag, over the years. She's listed infidelity, secret marriages, hiding, having multiple sex partners from her, hiding having multiple sex partners from her as some of the reasons for her charges, the D-bag tax. New York is the narcissist capital. They're not going to understand what you did really hurt my feelings because they don't grasp feelings. They grasp money. So hit them where they understand, in the pocketbook. What do you think of that?
I think that I would say 1,000 yards away from a woman like that.
Yeah.
She can't. Come on.
Yeah.
That just says a lot about her. And I would just say kindly walk away. Maybe just give her the $50 to cancel altogether, full outright.
Yeah.
And I'll throw in another 25. If you lose my contact information.
Well, I'd have to sign a separation agreement with a non-disparagement clause and and other particulars, I think.
Is she good looking at least? What has she got going?
I have no idea. I don't know.
Actually, I did see a picture of her.
Yeah.
She has green glasses like I have.
Sure, all the rage. Hazel Everett agreed to this whole D-bag thing. She sent a Venmo request to a man she'd been seeing for several months after he stopped communicating with her and sent her another woman's nude photos. That is sort of a D-bag move. I went to Venmo and requested $100, and for the highlight I wrote, wasting my time. He paid up.
Really?
Yeah. Never heard from him again, so I just kept the money.
Good.
That's closure in 2022 in America.
And it's another reason why Dan Proft is single.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Insert Democrat socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House law for 30 plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois. But you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay, no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when you're moving out. I said, when you're moving out.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This was sort of a fun moment that was captured. Black gentleman in Arcadia, Florida, which is rural southwest Florida, talking about supplies showing up, you know, as they're recovering from Hurricane Ian, like so much of southwest Florida, and offering this excited utterance about the gasoline that showed up to, you know,
help everybody fuel the generators.
Exactly.
About DeSantis, but that gas is here in Arcadia.
In Arcadia.
I don't know about the rest of y'all, but it's here in Arcadia. So y'all know who we vote for. I don't know about the rest of you motherfuckers, but I'm voting for DeSantis. And I'm a Democrat. So y'all can call it what the f*** y'all want to call it.
We got children out
okay,
here.
Okay, I'm sorry, ma'am. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
children.
Swearing.
We've got gas and children. So
swearing like Lizzo, that guy. Yeah,
good. That is awesome.
Yeah,
and this huge gasoline tanker that's right there in front of them.
It's a funny thing. No, nothing helps to change opinions more than, you know, delivering for people.
Yeah.
So the lack of delivering for people, you would think, would also change some attitudes. We're going to find out in this state on November 8th, since we have the anti-DeSantis here. Ted Dabrowski, president of Wirepoints, wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related, joins us now. Ted, thanks for being with us, as always. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
Yeah, how about that? Delivering for people and suspending the taxation on gas, but you know, doing it in a transparent way for specific reason, as opposed to, say, what we have here, where you've got a governor that doubles the state gas tax in order to... Well, by trade union support in particular. Yeah. Oh, I know. Fix Illinois' crumbling infrastructure. Right. Anyway, by trade union support. And then in the closing weeks of the election, tries to flim-flam the public by temporarily suspending the incremental inflationary increase in that gas tax that he doubled and calling that tax relief.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, when you look at all the policies that they've implemented, both, you know, Pritzker, Lightfoot, Preckwinkle, all of them, what a mess they've made of this state. And, you know, we're still at the bottom of the barrel in any metric when you compare us to the rest of the country. We're still at the bottom. And you know, it's inflation. It's, well, the lockdowns, all those things. It's the gas taxes, as you mentioned. It's the property tax hikes that have come along. And yet it's not just, you know, Dan, it's not just that little bit of relief on the gas taxes, right, that quote relief. It's, you know, Preckwinkle is out there handing out more money to you know, another $71 million to you know, people and businesses that have been left out, quote. You've got the basic income now coming from both Chicago and Cook County. You know, the handouts just continue. And every day, you know, Governor Pritzker is announcing some other $10 million, $30 million, $50 million grant to another group. It's really you would think it was illegal if you're kind of – you know, remove yourself from the whole process. It's
no,
illegal
that, right. And then
buying votes.
And then Willie Wilson giving away his own money, like buying people gas. Oh, my gosh. What is Willie Wilson?
Happened.
Oh, my. He's buying votes. Oh, horrors of horrors. I mean, they're just beyond duplicitous. And with respect to the universal basic income. So can I get $500 from Lori Lightfoot's universal basic income program, and if I'm a city resident, and then also go over to the county side and get between $500 and $3,200 from Preckwinkle's universal basic income program too.
I don't know who'd be.
Can I layer on those?
You want to double dip?
Yeah, can I? Why not? Like a public sector pensioner,
yeah,
I get to double dip.
Yeah.
What do you think?
But Dan, that happens. I mean, that happens already when you look at all these government programs, and this is this fiscal cliff thing where some people have got so many different layers of benefits that it would never make sense for them to go to work. Because they would lose all those benefits. They make more from getting all these benefits than not working. So, yeah, it happens all the time already. I don't know about this basic income doubling up, but, yeah, why not?
So let's,
I mean, it would be equity, right?
Equity.
Yeah, equity. Love that word. Day does not go by that I don't hear that word, Ted Dabrowski. So let's talk about the proposed workers' rights amendment. And is it a bad policy coming at the worst time?
I'm glad we're talking about that because it doesn't get enough attention. You know, Wirepoints, we've gone around the state quite a bit talking about it. People don't know about it. You know, it's called the Workers' Right Amendment, with quotes behind it. And it's funny, the Workers' Right Amendment would ban right to work in Illinois. But that's a different point.
Yeah,
really?
Right. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's again like Inflation Reduction Act. All these things do the opposite of what they say they're going to do. But anyway, this Workers' Right Amendment is would give, you know, if Illinois unions already don't have the most power in the country, and I'm talking about the public sector unions, which I would argue they already do. This will take their powers and enshrine them in the Illinois Constitution, make them the most powerful in the country, power over taxpayers, power over policy, power over taxation in a way, just because of the power to negotiate. And it would create a situation where no law, and this is what the amendment says, no laws shall be passed that diminish or negate the rights of the unions to negotiate and organize. So, Dan, when you were talking earlier in a different segment about destroying representation, well, this amendment would basically take out the lawmakers from being able to pass property tax reforms, improve parents' rights in schools. It would destroy all that. So, people have to make their vote on this, but it's a very destructive amendment.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of property taxes, that was one of the things Governor Spaulding promised to deliver. Do we have evidence of property tax relief? Are we supposed to believe, speaking of tax relief scams, that the $100 rebate check here coming in the last 4 weeks before an election, is that property tax relief? Does that mean people are paying lower property taxes than they were when he took office?
The quick answer is hell no. Everybody should know that most units of government in Illinois can automatically raise their property taxes by inflation. And so given that inflation is going to be 8%, and the max is 5% that can be raised automatically. So every property tax bill every city school district is going to raise their property taxes by 5% automatically. And so, forget your property tax relief. Your property taxes are going to go up more than what he's saying. So it's just like the gas tax, massive increases and then the pretend relief. Here he's saying that he's going to give you relief on property taxes. However, every single unit of government, or not every single, but most units of government will be raising their taxes by at least or by the most, which is 5%.
And by the way, those newspapers to which I'm affiliated and excoriated.
You're an insurrectionist, according to the Speaker of the House.
Yeah,
by the way. I don't know if you know that.
I know. It doesn't comport with the state set standards of what constitutes a newspaper, because, again, that's where you find your fourth estate.
You were here with me, but according to them, you were the Capitol on January 6th.
You were doing so. The state. So just so we understand, the position of the press corps is without state recognition, you're not a legitimate media outlet. And next phase, which has been in the offing for some time, been proposed, circulating, is you're not legitimate if you're not state funded. So a state funded, state recognized and soon to be state funded news outlets will be the fourth estate, will be your great, representative of the people's interests against the powers that be. They'll be afflicting the comfortable and comforting the afflicted. Sure they will. But I digress. With respect to property taxes, those same newspapers we're talking about published the property tax rates as a percentage of home value region by region. Those are the actual rates. Do you see the Tribune or the AFL-CIO, NPR Times do that, the Daily Herald? No, you don't. Do you have any sense of how your home value is eaten away at day after day after day in this state? No, you don't. And now you're really going to get a double dose in this green stagflationary environment with high mortgage rates and a diminished housing market. So that's what's happening.
Yeah, that's one of the things we try to tell people about the this amendment. One is that if you look at the home values over the last 20 years, take the data from the federal government and look at state by state. There are states where after you adjust for inflation, states have grown their property values 40, 50, 60, 70%. So, the nest eggs there have grown. In Illinois, we're at the bottom of the barrel. We're the third worst in the country. And we've grown 3% when you adjust for inflation. So that was through 2000 through 2020. So you can see what the property tax impact has already been, highest property taxes in the country, by definition, hit home values. And this amendment, one, if you're going to give the public sector unions more power to negotiate, and is constitutionally protected, and no law shall diminish those powers. Well, guess what? It's a one-way ticket to higher property taxes. There's no doubt about it.
One-way ticket to Palookaville. So here's the thing about CPS. Reading and math proficiency, what is it again? What's reading and math proficiency? Pick a grade, any grade
that they test. 11% or 6%.
It's 11% for the whole for blacks. It's 11%, and for Hispanics, it's 17%.
And in reading and math.
Yeah, reading and math, 11 and 17. Well, they're both roughly the same.
Okay.
Pretty close.
11, 17. But so that's weird because I see from the Illinois report card on the teachers. You posted this over at wirepoints.org. City of Chicago, 100% of CPS teachers were evaluated as excellent or proficient by an administrator or other evaluator trained in performance evaluation. 100% of the teachers are excellent or proficient, and yet 11 and 17% of the kids are with respect to reading and math, 11 and 17% of the kids are proficient in those two core areas of study. I don't understand.
Yeah, this is, again,
this is the best we can do?
Well, the best we can do, 100%, is about as good as you can do if you're a teacher. That's the evaluations. It's fascinating. You go into the Illinois report card. This is all their data they report. And, it makes me wonder, what are they thinking? How can they actually, publish this information? Because you just said 11% of black kids can read at grade level. So that means 89% can't. And 17% of Hispanics, which means 83% can't read. And they're pushed. If you look throughout the years, it's always really bad. So they're promoted along social promotion, and yet
apparently social promotion isn't just for the kids, it would seem.
Yeah, well, so you've got this 100% evaluation of excellent or proficient for teachers in the district, and it's just as bad at the state level. It's 98%. So basically, it's just a joke. It means nothing, and there's no accountability is really what it means. I think all these things just keep adding on to the arguments that school choice is the only way to go because these schools aren't helping the poor kids anymore. They're also not helping the community because a lot of them are empty. So all the arguments all the arguments for avoiding school choice are gone.
And I mean,
the only one argument left.
Just the numbers astounding. What do we have? 25,000 teachers in CPS?
Yeah, something like that.
To 25,000. Any organization with 25,000 people. You're going to tell me there's 100% excellent or proficient, 100% get flying colors in their performance review in any organ. Forget CPS. Any organization on the planet with 25,000 people. Nobody.
It's fake news.
Nobody is an outlier.
It's fake news.
Okay. Sure. Yeah.
And not only that, it happened in a year when they were not in school.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, they're doing forced remote learning. They had a walkout, forced remote learning. Kids, and we know what the data has been on the hit that kids have taken during COVID.
Yeah, people keep forgetting it was this year, January 2022, that they did not go to work for 5 days. So who was evaluating them? I mean, while they were at home on Zoom, give me a break.
Well, yeah. Well, it says it's by an administrator or other evaluator trained in performance evaluations. So these are qualified people.
And of course, they're doing the best they can because they're so underfunded.
Well, that's the other part of the story. What's fascinating, we haven't talked about the City of Chicago budget, but when you look at the spending at CPS, it is up, 40% in 4 years, which is, like a couple billion dollars. It's gone from $20,000 just 4 years ago to almost $30,000 this year. That's a 10,000 increase. It's massive. And remember, there's fewer students there as well.
Right.
So there's more and more money per student as people flee. It's a really sad story, but a story that needs to be told because it needs to be broken up and school choice has to take over.
People need to be imprisoned for the system they've been running for so many generations there, as far as I'm concerned. Ted Dabrowski, president, Wirepoints, wirepoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. Thanks, Ted.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560.
The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and one wag writing in the Tribune wrote about the Pritzker Purge Law, a.k.a. the Safety Act. Uh-huh. The public, as it tries to dissect the misinformation being thrown around by supporters of the act, need to focus only on one point. If the act's opponents are fearmongers, that's how the governors characterize them. If the act's opponents are fearmongers, how does that explain the many state's attorneys of all political persuasions across the state who collectively say the law is fundamentally dangerous? If the law is so solid, why are the experts on the ground so worried? I think that's an excellent way to frame it.
Yeah, I think I know.
Because that's from my op-ed.
That's his op-ed in the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a must read. It's an easy read, but it's good.
If I do toot my own horn there. Eric Weiss is the state's attorney for Kendall County. He's been there for 16 years as the state's attorney. He's been 26 years as a prosecutor. So he knows a little bit about this. I mean, maybe almost as much as the governor. Eric Weiss, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks. I appreciate being here.
So you're one of the state's attorneys who recently, along with Jim Glasgow, Democrat, Will County, Jim Rowe, Democrat, Kankakee County, filed suit against this law, against the state, to enjoin the implementation of this law on January 1, arguing that it's unconstitutional. Explain.
Well, a little bit about it. First, going back, you know, we try to make this as state's attorneys as not political. And I know sometimes people think this is a Republican issue. It's a Democrat issue. It's not. It's a public safety issue. And I think the filing by two Democrats were the first two to file, I think, shows that this is not the Republicans are just upset about the law or certain groups of people are upset. State's attorneys across the state are worried about what's going to happen. They know that this is unconstitutional. And that's why you're seeing many state's attorneys filing lawsuits on this case. The Safety Act, I know they put whatever words they want on a bill and it makes it difficult to not support something. The Safety Act does actually have a few good things in it. I mean, no one's against that police get more training. No one's against that there's accountability for what people do. And we
One thing to interrupt. The police training piece, there are some people, though, saying, police training in general, great, but not if it's an unfunded mandate imposed by the state, and there are people saying that.
And plus, what they don't do is they don't read the fine print. And I think that's the problem, again, when we focus on the Pretrial Fairness Act, as they call it, for the cashless bail system. You know, the idea, we don't want to lock people up, as we mentioned before we went on. I mean, we don't want to lock up some mother who stole a bag of diapers for 9 months awaiting trial. But nobody's there right now. That's not happening right now. There's already laws in place for that. We're talking about violent criminals that we won't be able to hold. And, you know, when you pass a bill at 3 o'clock in the morning and it's 700 pages and you don't read it all, and then you realize, well, we've got some problems, and then you don't fix it for a year and a half. You got to kind of wonder, why is that happening? Why are we wanting to let violent criminals out on January 1? And so state attorneys across the state have filed this lawsuit. They're very similar to each other. Define that it's unconstitutional. But as a practical sense, you know, I'm worried what's going to happen if the lawsuit is either not successful or they don't change the law in Springfield. And I know some people are hoping that, Springfield will take care of it. They'll fix it. But they're not going back into the General Assembly until after the election.
Right.
So you tell me what's going
to
happen.
So January 1st, what happens to the people? I know you're not in charge of the jail. The sheriff is.
Yes.
But what happens? Let's start with the...
Well, and that's even up to... No one knows whether this applies retroactive or not. If it's going to affect those who are already in custody, we believe it probably does, that a person will be able to choose if they want to go under the new law or the old law. But again, the law doesn't even address that one particular issue. But what's going
to
happen?
Choose if they want to go over the new law. Yeah. But let's see, do I want to go over the new law where I get released, or do I want to stay in prison?
I'm going to go with the new
Who's going to pick? Yeah, who's going to pick? I want to stay in prison. Maybe there's somebody. I guess it's possible.
Yeah,
they don't want to go.
But we look at, you know, just being able to hold people that are violent criminals, and what we've done is we've taken the discretion with judges, we've taken discretion with prosecutors, having attorneys on the other side be able to argue their position. We've taken it completely out of those hands, and we put it in the hands of the General Assembly, and we said, okay, these people are automatically getting out. Aggravated batteries, burglaries, aggravated DUI death crashes. Oof. Automatically. They cannot be held for any reason. threatening a public official. These are ones that are not even qualified to be held. Think about that for just a second. Someone commits a robbery, we can't hold you. A burglary, can't hold you. The family that has lost a loved one to that DUI crash is going to see that person out, what, the next day? That's what we're dealing with right now. And again, is cash the answer to everything? No, it's not. But it takes away that there's more to it than just the cash, because it takes away that ability for judges to say, you know what, you're a threat to the community, we're going to hold you.
And this is what proponents of the bill argue. We've tried to get some on, like Audra Wilson, Shriver Center on Poverty Law, I saw her in WGN. She's reading the talk, which is, by the way, supported by the Pritzker family, among others, of course. But she was on, and she's talking about the, because I want to repeat one of the arguments you're hearing from people like her. They won't come on and debate us. They won't engage state's attorneys, just like the legislators didn't. So we have to address their talking points in absentia because they can't stand and deliver on them, which is also telling. Well, wait a second, Eric. A judge still has discretion to hold somebody if the prosecutor makes the case that the person is a threat to public safety. That's what they say.
Sure. Let me give you the example that just shows the ludicrousy of how this law is written.
Okay.
Someone commits first-degree murder. So I don't like Amy. And the only person in the world that I don't like is Amy. So I go up to her and I kill Amy. And there's no question that I've done it. Come January 1, I won't, as a prosecutor, be able to hold me for killing Amy. Because not only do I have to show that the crime is eligible to be held, first-degree murder is one of them,
but
number two,
second degree
is not, right. So you wouldn't even qualify. But assume it's first-degree murder, one of the most heinous crimes there is, I wouldn't be able to be held because the specific identifiable threat person that I still hold a threat to is dead. Mm-hmm. Think about that for just a second. Think about all the domestic violence victims that will fall to this that are killed, that their offender will not be held. Now, it doesn't mean we can't charge them. Doesn't mean they won't be tried. They won't be convicted and serve time if they're convicted. But being held, we have to show the specific identifiable individual, not just a group of people, not a threat to the community. A child pornographer is a threat to children. What specific child? Sex offender. What specific child? What specific person? We have that is all going to change on January 1.
And that also applies to policing in the sense of use of force in real time, right? I mean, the police have to make a determination if they're involved in a confrontation with somebody, even to the extent of a shootout, and that person flees, whether they're allowed to give chase, whether they're allowed to use lethal force, all based on a specific identifiable threat the person poses. Not, there's a neighborhood or there's a school down the block and general threat. You need to be processing what's the specific threat that I can make out to justify pursuit and engagement.
And that's the problem we're having as we look at the Safety Act is the applicable reality of this process of whether it's a police officer making a split-second decision, whether it's prosecutors trying to hold people accountable and protect the community, or the judicial system in general. What are we going to be doing? And I'll give you just another quick example. What happens now if someone doesn't come to court? We issue a warrant.
Right.
It's not that common. If you have good cause, you may get a short continuance, but if you don't show up, you get a warrant. Come January 1, we're not going to be issuing warrants.
Why?
We won't be issuing warrants for people who don't show up. So even if you're out, we will have to go serve you with papers, show these rules to show cause.
Right.
So imagine if you're a cop, right, and some gangbanger in whatever neighborhood is out on bond, doesn't show up to court, or some victim of some violent crime. They're not going to go issue a warrant. They're going to go into that neighborhood. They're going to go in on that street, traffic stop, whatever it is, and they're going to attempt to serve a piece of paper. Then if they don't show up to court, we're going to issue a warrant. Now, think about how that works. These don't go into the computer system where they run you when they run your plate. These aren't things that are every police officer is going to serve. It's one county is going to have to serve all these type of papers before we can get warrants. If you're a victim of a crime and your case is going to languish now because the offender is nowhere to be found, how cooperative and how trustworthy of you, the system, are you going to be?
Well, and also, what incentive does it present for people alleged to have committed violent crimes and who are released to show up to court?
It's going to be very difficult for some of those people.
And I mean, in Glasgow and Will County, you said this too, says that, you know, they're not going to serve. They're not going to go to some of these shooting galleries, these neighbors that are shooting galleries, especially if they're coming from suburban counties, and serve
Well, just from a practical standpoint, aren't gonna do it. Just from a practical standpoint, there's not enough manpower to do it.
Yeah, well,
as it is.
Right.
I mean, just from a practical standpoint, if half the people that fail to appear in Chicago, they're going to go to Cook County for the Cook County Sheriff to serve, they don't have enough people to do it anyway.
No.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswer line. We'll take your calls if you have a specific question about Pritzker's purge law, the so-called Safety Act, for Eric Weiss, state's attorney for Kendall County, as we continue our conversation.
So Governor Pritzker, these are his two themes, you know, why he likes the Safety Act. One is, compare, you know, the mom who steals diapers. She wouldn't be arrested anyway, because don't you have to steal $500 or more worth of goods in order
she's not
to
being
be
held
with...
she's not being held she's not being held regardless.
And there's already laws in place that allow someone who actually is in custody, can't afford it, for nonviolent crimes to get money off their bond until they're released, even if they don't post anything. So every day they're in, they get money off their bond.
Okay.
Let's just dispel that whole thing
is such a fraud too, because it's not like there's opposition to releasing people charged with nonviolent crimes,
right,
you know, on the condition they show up to court. And
right.
So where's the opposition from that coming from? It's nowhere.
If you go to our jail right now, you're not going to see someone being held for $100 theft charge.
Right.
Here's his other theme that he keeps, you know, harping on. $1 million man. He's rich. He beats up his wife. He can pay for his freedoms.
That's true. And when you look at cash bail, there are some inequities when you use cash bail solely as the mechanism for releasing somebody or not. But taking away the discretion to do that, that's a problem. But if you want to eliminate cash bail, you can do it. I mean, you can do it, but you have to do it the right way. You have to give prosecutors and the court system a way to detain and hold those violent criminals. Not make the burden so high that there's no way you can hold anybody. There's an argument to be made that it would be almost impossible to show that no condition would keep somebody in custody, or sorry, would keep someone out. So everybody should get out. Under a liberal reading of that law,
right,
prosecutors will never make that burden. And that's a very scary thought when you start thinking about who the people that we're going to be letting out are. And again, cash bail, you can make an argument that there are some inequities. I won't disagree with that. But there are other alternatives. This just isn't it.
Yeah. I mean, right. There's ways to, I mean, and point of fact, New Jersey moved in that direction, but this was a laborious process that occurred over a year and a half or 2 years that included engagement with local prosecutors and sheriffs and so forth. So it brought the actual practitioners that operate our justice system, or their justice system in this case at the state and local level, into the fold to say, okay, how are we going to do this so that we are not putting repeat violent offenders, or frankly, predators, criminals, in a position where they can commit crimes that were preventable if we had just removed them from society pending trial.
That's correct. And again, it's a solution that can be fixed, and it can be fixed before January 1, but it's either going to go through the court system, and that's how we're going to fix it, which is never a good idea.
Oh, yeah.
Or the General Assembly will decide, hey, we really do see the problems, and we're going to fix them.
But were you ever a part of the conversation? Did they ever seek your advice or about this?
We participated on some. They were all Zoom back when this passed, obviously with COVID. We participated in those hearings to the best of our abilities. But when they came to practically walking through this process, no.
Well, let's take a couple calls. Roger, Southside, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, this is... should have never been in the hands of the lawmakers with the history we have in Illinois. This should have went to a ballot vote to even allow them to even start any type of negotiations about stuff like this. It's going to be a real crap show, you know, and I can only imagine the problems that our own law enforcement people are going to have dealing with this. And at the same time, at the federal level, they're going to be coming down on people like this gentleman and all the rest of this good law enforcement people in Illinois and here in Chicago. You know, this is just Marxism. It's nothing more.
Thanks for the call, Roger. Vince, St. Charles.
Good morning, guys. You know, we have the detention center in St. Charles. I think it's for juveniles. Okay. It's used. I don't know how many it houses or anything like that. How does the cash with bail work for juveniles, and what will be released out of that place? Thanks. So I could tell people and talk to people.
Thanks for the call, Vince. Yeah, what about, I mean, by the way, when I was growing up in Wheaton, I used to be threatened that I would be sent to St. Charles if I didn't straighten up my act and fly right. But I guess that's not a threat anymore.
Well, there's two different things. If juveniles are under a different system, they actually are under a cashless bail system. And it works because we don't have these limitations on all these different things. And most juveniles are not held. Most juveniles show up. Juveniles don't show up. We issue warrants. Those that are violent, we hold. They don't have these high standards. So that's actually a very good model of what you look at. Someone who steals a candy bar from Walmart, they're released.
So it seems to me that this is like getting to a fundamental point here. It's the discretion that has been removed from the system and creating unreasonably high thresholds, whereas more discretion in the system in the best interests of justice, both the constitutional rights of the accused as well as the safety of the public. This is what prosecutors and criminal defense attorneys and judges haggle about, and you arrive to decisions case by case.
Right, and there's never a perfect system, Dan. I mean, it is never going to be one. But there's also the, like you said, making the hurdle so high that nobody can make it or very, very few people are going to make it is not going to make our society safer. It's not going to make it better for the victims. It's not going to be better for the witnesses that report crimes. It's going to make it worse, and that's the problem we're going to face.
Cheryl, Midway, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi. I'd like to know, how is the average citizen supposed to protect themselves if they find somebody in their house, if this goes through, you know, and they're only going to write them a ticket?
Yeah, the trespass issue, that's gotten a lot of discussion. Thanks for the call, Cheryl. What about that?
You know, that's a great question, because there's a lot of, with law enforcement, we don't know. There's no good answer to some of these questions that they have. Is, you know, law enforcement hands are going to be tied in certain capacities where they're not going to be able to arrest people that are a problem to someone, which right now, if they didn't leave, we could arrest. And that puts a citizen in a very, very tough predicament of, what do I do? Which may end up themselves getting charged with something because they're trying to take care of their own property.
Right. So law enforcement, under this law, law enforcement is putting law-abiding citizens into a confrontation they don't want to have.
Right. They're
and
calling,
they're not trying to deal with.
They're calling the police, trying to do the right thing because they've got a situation where they want somebody gone.
It's insane.
And we're putting them in the spot of, well, it's your problem. You have to take care of it. And if you do something wrong, we're going to have to deal with you.
I mean, that is resonating because it's just so obviously ludicrous. It's sort of like it's what the former Riverside police chief Tom Weitzel wrote about in the Sun-Times the other day, that the 48 hours of disconnect right, before right. you can determine that somebody has fled
right.
and you can pursue them.
Right. So if you're on an electronic monitoring band, so you're out in custody and you cut the band. So we don't know where you're at. We have no idea to monitor you. We have to wait 48 hours before we can charge you with escape.
Oh my! Well, and by that time, you could be gone.
You could be
anywhere.
Right. And you could be back to the same location that you were not supposed to be at.
And the theory behind that arbitrary grace period?
You'll have to ask the General Assembly.
So arbitrary, just like COVID, like arbitrary. Everything's arbitrary. Well, 10 feet, 6 feet sounds good.
All right, let's take a break, and can you hold?
Sure.
All right, we'll take more of your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.prenceline. We're talking to Eric Weiss. He's the Kendall County State's Attorney, 16 years as State's Attorney, 26 years as prosecutor. So you have a practitioner in the space with the real-world implications of this law. So ask away. We'll take more of your calls after this.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're continuing our conversation with Eric Weiss. He is the Kendall County State's Attorney. He's been that State's Attorney for 16 years. He's been a prosecutor for 26 years, and we're talking about all the particulars of the Pritzker Purge Law, a.k.a. the Safety Act, that's set to go into effect January 1 from the perspective of a practitioner, somebody who does this every day, tries to put people behind bars who should be behind bars in the interest of protecting the public's safety. We're taking your calls as well, 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, if you have a question for Eric Weiss, Kendall County State's attorney. I wanted to pick up on something we didn't get to before the break, Eric, and that's this issue. Jim Glasgow in Will County has made a big deal about it. The 90-day clock to go to trial. You got 90 days or the accused walks. And, I mean, he's suggesting that that's just not enough time to deal with everybody who's going to say, put me on the 90-day clock at the same time in Will County, at least for him. But maybe to somebody hearing this who doesn't understand the nuances of the process, say, well, 90 days, that seems reasonable, right to a speedy trial. So what's the problem with the 90-day clock?
Well, you start looking at things, for example, most cases, more serious cases, whether it's a shooting, a sex assault, are going to involve our crime lab. Whether that's collecting samples, whether that's blood, whatever it happens to be, it's going to get sent there, whether it's a firearm. Those lab results have to be back processed to us, turned over to the defense, and have allowed them to review those in that 90-day window. There currently aren't enough forensic scientists in the state of Illinois. If everyone demands trial, that 90-day trial, to get those done fast enough to keep those people in custody and have your trial within 90 days. It's just not a practical thing. Right now, we don't even have, most of our cases, we don't have the ability to have those fast-tracked. But imagine if every case had to be fast-tracked.
Right.
There's no way. There's not enough time in the day.
There's just not enough people. And that's going to be part of the problem. And it becomes this chess game where defense attorneys will play it against prosecutors of, well, we know you're backlogged. We know there's an issue, so we're going to immediately demand trial because we know you can't do it within 90 days, or we know it's going to be very difficult, or trying to get the witnesses in and get everything done in time is going to be difficult. Again, I have no issue with this, with the right to a fair and speedy trial. Obviously,
right.
We all want that.
Right.
I think we don't want to keep holding people for no reason.
Right.
But most cases do take time to go through the system, and usually it's on issues outside of the prosecutor. But this is going to put that us under the clock from day one.
And so if you don't beat the 90-day clock, then somebody who is otherwise being detained, and that's no easy feat under this law, right, as we were talking about before the break, then they walk. And now you're in the same situation of having to you bring them back in for trial when you're ready to go.
Right. And that's going to be the problem we're going to have. And again, there's already currently, just to be fair, there is already currently a Speedy Trial Act that's in place now. So the defendants have a right. But when you have that right of why you're just being held as well, it gives an additional incentive to try to get them out of custody. And again, we're right back to the same issue of if you've got in Kendall County, I don't have the same problem that Will County has. I don't have that many murder trials that are stacked up ready to go to trial.
Right.
They do. DuPage County, Cook County, Lake County, go through all the bigger counties, even Vermilion County down south. They've got a lot of cases where they've got murders waiting to be tried. How fast can you get them to trial? That's going to be the issue.
Sorry to interrupt, but without cutting corners, I mean,
correct,
this is like rush to trial, but we're not prepared. Right. And then you have somebody who committed a capital crime gets off.
Right. Go to a gunfight with only two bullets.
Yeah.
Right. It's kind of that argument. Instead of bringing everything that you have, you're going to bring only what you can do within that time frame. That may be a decision prosecutors are going to have to make.
Have you discussed your concerns with other state's attorneys throughout the state of Illinois?
Yes, we actually have conference calls. We have individual calls back and forth. Obviously, I've been on many of those calls. I get calls from the less experienced prosecutors like, what are we going to do? And sometimes we don't have answers for it yet.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 64636. Type in DA and a quick comment.
Bill on the northwest side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan.
Go ahead, Bill, you're on. Go ahead.
All right. My thought is this. With this pretrial release and no cash bail, we talk about the offenders being out on the street to making the victims feel unsafe, but this also opens up the avenue of witness intimidation as well, which will affect state's attorneys to successfully prosecute these individuals.
Thanks for the call, Bill. What about that?
Yeah, that's actually another problem we're going to have. We see those, especially in gang cases. Intimidation is very common. And the more the offender is out, or the more things that we can't do to hold that person, the more opportunity they're going to have to do that intimidation or to show a presence to that person. And situation may change for that witness.
What about this idea that, you know, the suburbs may not be, and many suburbs may not be dealing with what the suburban Cook County is dealing with, or certainly the city, or some, you know, mid-sized urban centers around the state, Rockford, Joliet, Aurora.
Sure.
But you make this the law statewide, and essentially you've removed the barriers for mobile individuals who have bad intentions to go from the west side to the western suburbs or the south side to Will County, that Chicago crime can, I mean, it really has already to some extent, but Chicago crime can find its way to the suburbs.
Well, and that's the case. And we're very fortunate in the county that I work in, and our law enforcement's very vigilant. We, you know, a lot of criminals don't want to come to Kendall County because they know they're going to get prosecuted. They know that law enforcement's going to be watching them. We take an aggressive stance. But when there's those barriers are removed, why not? What's to prevent you from leaving Cook County where maybe they don't prosecute the same way they do in Kendall or Will or DuPage and start making your way out this direction? And that's, we're already seeing that, as you mentioned a minute ago, and we're going to continue to see more of that as those barriers to prosecution become more and more prevalent after January 1.
Not fear-mongering. That's just the reality. I mean, people respond to incentives. And here again, whether it's in the suburbs or the exurbs or in the city, it's a small percentage of the people, but a small percentage of the people can create unbelievable headaches and do unbelievable damage to other people. And that's, it seems to me, all that people are trying to prevent.
Well, you know what? You asked me during the break, and I think a lot of the people have started to come up to me and say, is this really this bad?
They can't believe it.
Is it really? That can't be the law, right?
Right.
And I kind of refer to them as, and it's probably a bad analogy right now with the hurricane that went through, but it's like a tsunami coming. I'm telling you it's coming. I'm not a fear monger. I'm telling you this is the practical reality of what's going to happen January 1. I'm going to work on January 1. So I'll still have a job. I'll still be doing my job as I do now. But the residents that live in my community, the residents that live in Will County or DuPage or Cook or Sangamon, wherever they live, are going to see this effect. They're going to see violent criminals, and they're going to turn to us going, why is this happening?
Right.
And I'm going to hold up this 700-page bill and go, well, here's why.
Right. Remember, you weren't paying attention for the, you know, months leading up to the election. Right.
I don't want to be, I told you so, but
no,
this is the one, this is the time of, it's coming.
Right. I mean, this is what we're trying to, you know, like, you know, snap mm-hmm. people out of it. Don't believe me? Then, you know, go ask your local prosecutor. Right. Go ask your police chief. Go ask your sheriff.
I'll show you the bill if you want to come read it. It's right here.
Let's read it together. We'll have story hour at the libraries. Yeah. Because that bill will put you to sleep. And then you'll have nightmares about its implications.
No.
Marge on the Northwest side.
I just have a question. I'm not sure how this process works, but if you have all the state's attorneys who are not on board with this yet, because there are things obviously in this bill that need to be fixed, can they just tell this governor, I'm sorry, we're not ready. This is going to have to be extended until we can all be on board and have something in place to prepare for it? Can't they just say, not now, too bad, or we don't have that kind of power against the governor?
Thanks for the call, Marge.
Well, the General Assembly could do that, and the governor could sign a bill to postpone the implementation of the pretrial fairness portion. They could do that, and they've done it in other sections. But as of right now, it's going into effect January 1.
But
state's attorneys can't do it. We can't say we're just not going to follow
the law.
Well,
you have Speaker Welch and other you know, Black Caucus members that are just like, no, we're not touching this. We want it to stand as it is.
And if you refuse to follow the law, then, well, you can be removed.
Right. And
yeah.
We took an oath to follow the law.
Yeah,
so
we're
right.
going
to
do
you
that.
Have to.
We're going to do that.
No,
it's just, there's a way to fix it. It's just whether they will.
Michael, Southside.
Good morning.
Morning.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. Thank you for taking my call. I have concerns about whether or not the law would be enforced equitably. Let's take, for example, the trespass issue. We do assume that if someone trespasses at, say, Jesse Jackson's property or, say, a Hilton property, will that person
Hyatt,
I'm sorry, thank you. Will that person get a ticket, or will that person go straight to jail? I think we all know the answer to that one. Whereas the same act committed against an ordinary citizen will probably only get a ticket. So I have concerns about whether or not the judges will even apply the law equitably.
Oh, thanks for the call, Michael. What have the conversations been with judges about this? I mean, if you guys are confused about some of this, if you're looking for guidance, I assume they are too.
They are. We've had conversation with our judges. We've had conversation. I know the judges have had conversation statewide. We even have conversation whether this applies retroactive to those that are in custody.
Right.
And judges are split on whether it does. So if you imagine if the judicial system doesn't know what's going on and prosecutors don't know what's going on when it comes to this issue and the nuances, how are we going to implement it on January 1?
What a cluster. Tim on the Kennedy.
Hey, Dan. Good morning. Just a comment. Been a policeman for almost 28 years, and I talk with my peers about when we started and we have all these Democratic politicians are throwing tens of billions, if not hundreds of millions, at these neighborhoods, North Lawndale, Inglewood, Austin, and we unfortunately, we laugh a little bit and say, hey, it's no better. It's probably worse than it was 28 years ago, and they're all proud of themselves saying, hey, let's do this. Let's do another program. Let's throw millions of dollars more at it, but nothing ever gets done, which is wondering what your comment might be to that.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's hard to disagree with that observation. That's what I would say. That's sort of where we're at, which is, you know, why the advocacy for a paradigm shift in the power structure. Joe in Arlington Heights.
Good morning. Thank you for covering this in such great depth. So it's reported that 100 of 102 state's attorneys object to this in some level or degree.
Yes.
We hear politicians talking about it. Have judges, any judges in the state come out and made any comment, any observation, or are they just hiding under rocks?
Thanks for the call, Joe.
Well, judges aren't allowed to make comments on litigation, so they are, whether they feel that way officially or not, they can't do that. So I don't want to say judges are hiding, but that's the problem. But I think you just hit the point. 100 out of 102. It's very rare that you can get Republicans and Democrats, who are split about 50-50, to almost unanimously agree that there's a problem. That should say something.
And I would add, too, I mean, you don't have to comment on this, but I would add, too, it's rare when you get Democrats to publicly break bad against a Democrat governor. Very rare. I don't care what their position is. And even the Democrat state's attorneys that are doing so in a very genteel fashion, their message is unmistakable, and it's not inconsistent with anything that Republican state's attorneys like yourself are saying, really. Tom in Galesburg.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. Just a quick observation. There's an old adage that structure must follow strategy. And it occurs to me the structure of this law is predicated on a strategy of predictable outcomes of Marxism. And until people back up and see the big picture of what the Democrat Party is doing, not only in Illinois, not only in Chicago, but across this country, we're having a hard time understanding a supposed political party and what its motives are. But that is the only explanation for what they're trying to do, which is a total takeover of this country.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Well, I mean, I got to tell you, Eric, one state's attorney said to me off the record, I mean, that this is essentially this legislation, the Safety Act, this is essentially written for gangbangers. I mean, that's the constituency it serves. That's what the state's attorney said to me.
Well, again, I don't want to put words in other state attorneys' mouths. I will say just from my standpoint, it will result in the release of offenders who should be in custody. For what purpose? I'll leave that to everyone else to make that decision. Yeah. But the reality is that many offenders who should be detained or in custody or under the control of the court will not be.
Doesn't get much clearer than that. John in Bridgeport.
Hi, real quick, guys. 2 weeks ago, you had Rob Blagojevich on telling the listeners that it's the DNC that was dictating the policy regarding immigration and abortion. Do you feel it's the DNC dictating this policy as well? Because we're not the only state heading in this direction. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the call, John. Speaking of people who should be in custody, Rob Blagojevich.
Hey, stop.
What do you see around the country? You see New York did a facsimile of this. You've seen defund the police movements in these big cities that are dominated by Democrats for the last 2 years. And then it moved to decarceration prosecutors funded by George Soros. I mean, that's what we've been talking about. You hear Larry Krasner from Philadelphia. We played his comments yesterday, just making up violent crime statistics. So, you know, whether it's orchestrated or not, I don't really know. And I don't really care because, I don't know, I judge people based on what they do, not what they say. And we see what these politicians, prosecutors around the country, including Kim Fox and including Al Reinhardt in Lay County, the two county state's attorneys who supported the Safety Act, Kim Fox and Eric Reinhardt in Lay County. Nice job, Lay County. Well done.
Are they part of your conversation?
Just watching what they do. Just watching what they do. There's 100 out of 102. Now you know who the two outliers. Steve, Northwest Side.
Hi. As you probably know, I'm a retired Chicago police officer, and I've said since the inception of this bill that this law was written by gangsters for gangsters, and people think they thought I was crazy. Just like our government was infiltrated by the outfit years ago and the communists and this and that, it's infiltrated by gangsters. It's not, and I know that sounds crazy, but it's not. Look at some of the people behind all this. This is an effort to get gangsters that are currently in jail, out of jail, and to prevent future gangsters from going to jail. People better smarten up, get their head out of the bus, and pay attention to what's going on. Then thanks for all you do, Dan. I know you're putting a lot of your own money in this, and a lot of effort and a lot of hard work, and thank you. That's all I got to say.
Thanks, Steve. So, you know, here's the thing, you know, Eric, we talk a lot about police morale being so low around the country. I mean, particularly in places like Chicago. What is the suit of prosecutor morale? Do you think this goes into effect and you start to people get into being a prosecutor like you to, you know, be a public servant and put bad guys away to protect law abiding citizens? If you can't do that, I guess that starts to get a bit frustrating and state's attorney's offices are going to lose good prosecutors, like police departments are losing good officers.
I think you'll see that, unfortunately, down the road. I mean, people will get frustrated with the fact of what's the point. If I keep doing the right thing and I'm working hard and I'm trying to do the right thing for our community and they just keep making things tougher and tougher for us and there's no consequences for those that continue to violate the law, what's the point of me being here? Why don't I go be a real estate lawyer? Why don't I go do corporate law, do something where at least I'll be compensated for the work I do in a better way, because prosecutors aren't.
Right.
And what's the point? And the morale over time, to do this for 25, 30 years, it's going to be much more difficult to get good prosecutors into the offices and then to stay in the offices for long term. And that's what you need to do this job.
He is Eric Weiss. He is the Kendall County State's Attorney. 16 years as the state's attorney, 26 years as a prosecutor. Eric, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time and insights.
I appreciate both of you having me here.
Great.
Thank you.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
The following is a paid political announcement.
I'm Dr. Willa Wilson, and I approve this message.
2021 marked Chicago's deadliest.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.